What we are going to do today is based on the fact that we are now reading the final parshiot of the Torah. We are making our way through the end of Devarim. What I'd like to do around this time of the year is to take a look back and look at the Torah as one complete picture. Meaning, what themes can we learn by looking at Torah as a whole, as opposed to looking at it story by story? So what I'd like to try to do today, and we'll do as much as we can, is to propose the following theory and try to prove it, which is that if you look throughout the entire Torah, starting with Bereishit, we have 12 different Shvatim, we have 12 tribes. Each one in Sefer Bereishit has a very specific personality. They have certain character traits, certain things that happen to them, certain personalities that come through in the stories. If you then look at the rest of Tanakh, not just Torah, but the whole Tanakh, you see that that same exact personality and the same character traits and the same happenings seem to happen to their descendants over and over again. Meaning somebody from Yosef will get the personality of Yosef, and that will happen over and over again in history. Someone from Yehuda will be the same. So if you look at the chart, I charted out for you what I'd like to try to do today, which is I gave you the different personalities and the different people that I'm going to discuss. We'll see how many Shvatim we can go through, but in theory I'd like to go through the following. I'd like to show how, as I call Reuven, he is the should-have-been leader. Yosef is the second-in-command leader. Yehuda, the real or the ideal leader. Binyamin, the substitute leader. Dan, the leader of the maid children. And Shimon, the nothing leader. Which is, I'd like to see how many we can get through, but we'll see when my hour seems to go up. So let's start with Reuven, the should-have-been leader. I am not going to read every source in the source sheet. There's a tremendous amount. But what I did is I gave to the psukim so you could follow along with me as I run through the stories. Sometimes I will read them. Sometimes I'm just going to refer to them. You can follow along with me, if you'd like, in the source sheet. The first time we hear about Reuven is when he is born. And already the tone is set for Reuven when he is born in the fact that if you look at the naming of Reuven in Bereishit Chaf Tet, Pasuk Lamed Bet, Vatahar Leia Vatelad Ben, Vatikra Shemo Reuven, Ki Amra Ki Ra'a Hashem Ba'ani Ki Ata Yaven Yishi. What does Leia say? Very sad, actually. Oh, look, I have a son, and I'm going to name him based on the fact that God has seen my tortures, that God has seen my troubles. Maybe now my husband will love me. What is Leah talking about? As we all know very well, Leah was not supposed to marry Yaakov. Yaakov really wanted to marry Rachel, but instead he was tricked and he married Leah. And based on that, he does not like Leah very much, and maybe doesn't treat her as a loved wife. And Leah knows full well that he does not love her. So when she names her first child, it's, thank God I have a child. Maybe now my husband will love me. It shows you a little bit of how Reuven is coming into this world, kind of with this stigma behind him of, though I may be the before, though I may be first, my father does not love my mother and possibly does not love me either. And we see this throughout his stories. The next time we hear of Reuven is the story of the Dudaim in Bereishit Lamed. Reuven comes and gives his mother some Dudaim, some flowers he finds in the field. It's a very strange story, because if you look at the Psukim, Rachel and Leah get into a little bit of a fight here. Rachel wants the flowers, Leah wants the flowers, and Rachel ends up trading a night with Yaakov for the flowers. Why do we care about flowers? What is the story? It's so weird. The Mefarshim have a bit of a machloket about the point of the story. Ibn Ezra brings up an opinion that it's possible these flowers had some magical powers in some way to help women get pregnant. If it's true, what's the story about? A boy, a little boy, knows that his mother is in trouble and wants to help her with her troubles. So he goes and he gets flowers to help his mother get pregnant. This is something a little child should not know about. He should not be involved in. Or, as Ramban and Radak point out, it has nothing to do with getting pregnant. It's just flowers, that a child shows his mother his love through flowers. If that's true, why is the Tanakh telling us this story? Because it's showing us, once again, Reuven realizes the pain of his mother. He sees it. He feels it. He understands it. So what does he do? He tries to cheer up his mother. He brings her flowers. And Rachel so badly wants the love of a child, she'll trade a night with Yaakov, something she takes for granted, the love of Yaakov, for the love of a child. So what we see here already is not just Reuben is born into a rough situation, he understands his situation. He knows his father doesn't feel the way about him and his mother the way his father should, and therefore is acting as a young child to try to help out his mother in this horrible situation. We then go on, and it becomes very clear to us that Reuben knows full well what's going on. In Bereishis Lamed Gimel, when his father is about to meet up with Esav, and his father's obviously very nervous, we hear all the preparation and all the fear that Yaakov has about meeting his brother who wants to kill him, and his final preparation, what does he do? He sets his family in a specific order. He puts the people he's kind of ready to sacrifice first, to save the people in the back. So the Psukim tell us who goes first. But Tigasha Shvachot Hena V'Yaldeim V'Tishtach Avena. He puts the maidservants and their children first. But then who's next? V'Tigash Gam Leah V'Yaldeha. Then comes Leah and her children, of course, including Reuven. And Yosef and Rachel are in the back. It is clear to Reuven. It is clear to the brothers. But Reuven, who's the oldest and knowing what's going on, they are not the favorite. They are not Yaakov's favorite. Yaakov obviously favors somebody else, and Reuven is not being treated as the favorite Bechor as he feels he should be. Meaning normally we have the Bechor being the one who takes over the favorite role, the one who's going to be the chosen son. And from the beginning it is clear to Reuven that's not the role he's going to get. And from the moment Yosef is born, I think Reuven realizes this. As we'll see when we discuss Yosef, it is very clear Yosef is the chosen son from the beginning. And therefore Reuven has this dilemma. I want to be that chosen son. I am the Bechor, right? I am the first one that was born to Yaakov. I should have it, but I don't. What am I going to do about this situation? I want it. I want that position. We have the next story that we have about Reuven, the weirdest story. In Perek Lamed Hei Pasuk Chafet, Vayivishkon Yisrael Be'eretz Ahi, Vayilach Reuven Vayishkavetz Bilha Pilegesh Avi Vayishma Yisrael. Reuven goes, and the Pasuk tells us he sleeps with Bilha, the Pilegesh, the concubine of his father, and Yaakov hears about it. Now, a famous Rashi on this pasuk says, of course, that's not what it means. What does it mean? Reuven went, and went once Rachel was dead, and Yaakov moves his bed, his permanent bed, into the tent of Bilha. Reuven saw that as an insult to his mother. How could it be that you're going to live permanently with a maid over my mother? Look how you clearly choose a maid of my mother. I mean, how insulting can that be? So what does Reuven do, according to Rashi? Takes the bed and moves it into his mother's tent, right? In that situation, if that's what the pasuk is telling us, again, we clearly see Reuven knows what's going on. Reuven is insulted by the situation, defending his mother. Radak, however, points out, no, the pshat is what really happened, which is Reuven really went and had a sexual relationship with his father's concubine, with his father's wife. Now, if that's true, why? I mean, that's so weird. Why would he do that? I bring you to two other stories in Tanakh with similar themes to kind of understand it. I gave it to you on your sheet. I'm not going to read them inside. I'll just explain. There is a story of Ishbosheth. Ishbosheth is the son of Shaul. And once Shaul is killed, Ishbosheth becomes the king. Shaul and his sons are killed, and Ishbosheth is the only one left alive. Ishbosheth becomes king. Now, Ishbosheth is not a very good king, but he's successful for a little while because he has his father's general with him, which is Abner, right? His Sar Tzeva with him. And now Ishbosheth is the king of 10 tribes, and David at the time now has the other two. Now Ishbosheth one day comes to Abner and accuses him, how dare you have slept with this woman Ritzba. Now Ritzba was a Pelegesh of Shaul, and he accuses him of sleeping with him. Now Abner reacts in a vehement way and says, how dare you do that? How dare you accuse me of that? Just for that, I'm ditching you, Ishbosheth. I'm joining David. And in that, he unites the entire, Jewish people together under David. He basically destroys Ishbosheth's melucha over the fact that Ishbosheth tells him or accuses him of sleeping with Ritzba. Very strange story. I'm going to tell you the second one, then we'll understand all of them. There's a second story, it's also very odd, which is when Shlomo becomes king. Shlomo becomes king, but right before David says that Shlomo's supposed to become king, his older brother, Adoniyahu, decides to declare himself as king. Now, Bathsheba, the mother of Shlomo, comes crying to David saying, wait a second, you said Shlomo's supposed to be king. So David then gets up and he anoints Shlomo as king. Adoniyahu has to step down. Okay, but now Adoniyahu is not leaving without a fight. So what does he do? He goes to Bathsheba, the mother of Shlomo, and says, you know, I really should have been king. It was nice of me to step down. Do me a favor. Go to Shlomo and request from him that I can marry Avishag. Avishag is that woman that when David was very cold, she used to lie with him, right? So I want to marry Avishag. Go tell Shlomo as a kind of compensation for me not being king, I want to marry her. And of course, Shlomo's reaction to his mother is, I'll do anything you say, Mom, but this I'm not going to do. do. This is Adoniah who clearly trying to take over the Malucha, and not only does he say no, he kills Adoniah for this request. What do we see from here? When somebody has a sexual relationship or wants to marry the pilegesh of somebody else, of the king, of somebody in power, that's them saying, I am taking over that power. That's them saying, I deserve the power that you have. So Avner sleeping with the pilegesh of Shaul is saying, Avner saying, I'm like I'm king. And if Adoniahu wants to take Avishai, that's like Adoniahu saying, I'm king. So when Reuven goes and he has whatever he does with Bilhah, that's as if him saying, and I'm king, because Yaakov wasn't king, but I'm next in line. I really am the one who's supposed to be that next power, not who you seem to be giving it to, which we'll see later, is really Yosef. So we see here Reuven realizes he's not getting the Bechor status he's supposed to get, and in one way or the other, he's trying to grab it, he's trying to pull it, and he's trying to get it for himself, of course, unsuccessfully. The next time we see Reuven, we see him not in terms of his father's eyes, but we see him in terms of his brothers, meaning we see very clearly his father does not recognize him as the Bechor status. He does not recognize him as the leader of his children. But how about his own children? What do they see? Reuven's the Bechor. How do they view Reuven? So when we see Reuven with his brothers, is right before Mechiras Yosef, right before Yosef is sold, where the brothers see Yosef coming towards them and they say, ooh, let's kill Yosef. Reuven says, no. Parak Lamed Zayin Pasuk Chavav. Vayishma Reuven vayitzileu miyadam. Reuven hears them saying, let's kill him. He saves Yosef. Vayomer lo nakenu nefesh. Let's not kill him. Sounds great. Vayomer aleim Reuven, al tishpuchu dam, heshlichu oto el habor hazeh, asher b'midbar. Let's throw him in the pit instead. V'yad al tishlichu bo. So we don't harm him. We don't touch him. We don't do anything bad to him. Of course, throwing him into a pit, not so nice, but at least we're not killing him. Laman hetzila tomi adam hashivol aviv. What's his intention? He wants to go save him later and bring him back to his father. I mean, what's his intention? Throw him in the pit. You guys will get distracted. Go somewhere else. I'll come back to the pit, take him out, save him. What do we see from Reuven? Sounds good a little bit, but we see a number of issues with him. Number one, a leader would not have had this plan. A leader would have come to his brothers and said, we are not killing Yosef. You're going to leave him alone, and that's final. Go away. Right? That's what he would have said. He wouldn't have said, let's throw him in a pit, pretending to be part of the brothers of let's harm Yosef. You know, throw him in a pit is a great idea. He's going to die because he's going to starve in the pit, and we won't have done anything. That's the idea of Reuven, right? But his brothers think Reuven's just as bad as they are. He wants to hurt Yosef just the same. He couldn't actually tell his opinion, which was, let's leave him alone. He couldn't assert that power because he didn't feel it with his brothers. On top of that, we see what happens at the end. He throws him in the pit. Does Reuven save Yosef? Absolutely not. Why does Reuven not save Yosef? Because whatever happened, the brothers sell Yosef, someone else sold Yosef, very unclear. But Reuven leaves. He leaves at this point, comes back to the pit, looks inside, Yosef's gone. His plan didn't work. Now, if you had a plan to save Yosef and you throw him in a pit because you want to take him out, you would stay by that pit. You'd say, I'll be on guard here. You guys can all go have lunch. I'll hang out by the pit for a little while. And then, of course, you make sure your plan works. What does Reuven do? This is not the quality of a leader. He doesn't see his plan through. He takes a walk. I don't know. The Mefarshim try to figure out where did he go. You know, did he go daven? Did he go pray? Did he go for, I don't know where he went. He went somewhere, came back, Yosef's gone. Not great leadership, didn't see his plan through. Number three, we see a little bit of issues with his leadership, is that 2 seconds later, I don't know where Reuven went, but he disappeared, Yehuda gets up and says, oh, I have a better idea, let's sell Yosef. You don't hear any brother saying, well, you know what, Reuven's really in charge, so I don't want to go back on what he said, you know, let's stick to Reuven. You don't hear that at all. The brothers say, oh yeah, better idea, yeah, we don't care about Reuven. Meaning, there was no fear of the brothers at all in dismissing Reuven's idea completely and taking upon themselves Yehuda's idea of selling Yosef, and we never see later the brothers even feeling bad that they ditched Reuven's idea. So we see from here, even though it does sound pretty positive, he doesn't want to kill Yosef, that's good, but on the other hand, he does not have the leadership qualities to make this plan happen. The brothers don't fear, you know, that they have to listen to his plan. He himself couldn't say what his plan really was because he was too scared of the brothers, and he doesn't make sure the plan actually happens. And that's really that most of what we see about Reuven, as we just a few more psukim about him till the end, which is when the brothers now are down in Mitzrayim, they're facing Yosef, and Yosef accuses them of being spies and all these terrible things, and then finally Yosef takes them and throws them all in jail. Then he takes Shimon and puts him in jail and says, you can't come back to see me until you bring back Benjamin. What does Reuven do? Here's where we need a leader of the tribes to come up and say, I got a plan. Here's my plan. What does Reuven do? If you look at the Psukim, Vayan Reuven Otam Lemor, Halo Amarti Alechem Lemor, Al Tachtu B'Yelet, Velo Shamatim, Gam Tamoh Nidrash. Ha ha, didn't I tell you? Didn't I tell you to leave him alone, right? It's all your fault. Didn't I tell you? First of all, we don't see him ever telling them anything, so it could be that it happened, it wasn't in the Psukim, or it could be he's just making up that he told them. But the point is that in a situation like this, which is a very rough situation, the brothers needed someone with a plan. Someone to say, okay, this is what we're going to do. We're going to go home. We're going to tell our father this. We're going to do that. Whatever it was. What does Reuven do? It's not my fault. It's your fault. You did it. I didn't do it. This is all your fault. That is not the quality of a leader. On top of that, when we now get back to Yaakov, Reuven does step up. Okay. Says to his father the story. Says, you know, Yaakov, I need to take Binyamin with me. We got to go back to Mitzrayim. What does Yaakov say to him? Absolutely not. No way, Reuven, is what he says to him. And then that's it. Reuven gives up. Sorry, I tried. Nope, sorry, didn't work. I tried. We'll all starve now. It's okay. And that's really the end of Reuven. He wants to be that leader. He feels it. But he can't do it. He doesn't have the qualities of leadership whatsoever. At the end of the day, he blames others. He can't convince anyone of anything. And he is not trusted by anyone. And what's interesting is that when it comes down to, you know, the end of the story where Yosef turns to the brothers and wants to take Binyamin away because of the whole goblet thing, right? Reuven never says a word. He's missing. That's it. We're done with the Reuven stories because they're over, right? That's the time where the leader of the tribe should have gotten up and said, this is ridiculous. Binyamin didn't do anything. You can't keep Binyamin. Reuven is silent. And that's what we see about Reuven. He has the desire. He has the want. He does not have the qualities. He does not have that ability to be the leader of the Jewish people. And that's going to reflect itself in the rest of Tanakh. Meaning he does have some leadership qualities. He is the Bechor. So he will show up in some of Tanakh, but never as that leadership quality that he'd like to have. We start off in the rest of Tanakh with a few small details about Reuven. Number one, he is the head of a degel, which we see in Bamidbar Bet. But of course, he's not the first head of the degel. He's the second head, starting with Yehuda. He's number two. Because again, as we'll see with Reuven, he can never be the leader of anything. He does not have the quality to do that. What's fascinating is the biggest players that we have in Tanakh from Reuven are the characters of Datan and Aviram. Datan and Aviram are the people that joined together with Korah in the rebellion against Moshe. Now that makes a lot of sense that someone from Reuven would have that problem, right? That's a very Reuven problem. I want to be leader. I think I should be leader. You, the leader who's doing a great job, you stink and I don't want you to be the leader, right? That's very Reuven. But what's even more telling about Reuven is even within the rebellion, which is a very Reuven type of rebellion, they're not the main leader of the rebellion because that's not a Reuven thing. They can't be the main leader of anything. Korach's the main leader, right? He's from Levi. That makes sense. Datan and Aviram are kind of the sidekicks of Korach, right? Rebelling and saying, we want to be leader too, kind of on the side. And when Moshe says, okay, face me, let's have a face-off, come face, they don't even show up, right? That's very Reuven-esque. They don't even show up to their own rebellion, rebelling that they want to lead. They want it, but they can't do it. That's the Reuven characteristic. On top of that, we have a few more situations of Reuven, not leaders from Reuven, but rather stories where Reuven comes in. Of course, the famous story of Reuven and Gad. Reuven and Gad come to Moshe and Bamidbar Lamebet, and they say, we want to stay on the Eiver LeYarden, we don't want to cross into Eretz Yisrael. Now, the Pasuk tells us because they have a lot of animals, I mean, everyone has a lot of animals, what may be what's going on behind there is Reuven's thinking to himself, I cross over, I'm led by the leadership tribes, which we'll see, Yehuda, Yosef. I don't want to be led by the leadership tribes. I want to be on my own. I want to have my own land. So Reuven says, you know what? I'd rather stay on this side. I can kind of be my own authority on this side. But what's even ironic within that is if you look at the Pasuk Bet here that I gave you, Vayevo b'nei Gad u'b'nei Reuven, and they come to Moshe to complain. Ramban points out there, isn't that order weird? Normally you have, you know, the older tribes like Reuven, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda being listed before, you know, the maidservants tribes of Gad, Naphtali, Dan, right? Why, says Ramban? Because even within this request, Reuven was just a tag along to God. It was God's idea. And Reuven said, oh, great idea. I want to do that. Even they couldn't be a leader within this story. They were leading really behind God. And what's fascinating, the story plays out itself in Yoshua Chafet, which is that pretty soon after Reuven and God finish fighting for the Jewish people, and Yoshua gives them permission to go home, right away they build a mizbeah. The Jewish people are so quick to assume they've left us. They're now serving Avodah Zarah. They're doing their own religion. They've left us. Let's fight a civil war against them because they have left us. So quick to assume that. Why would they be so quick to assume that? It must be there was something about them that made them just think right away, oh, they must have left the Jewish people because that's what they've been wanting to do this whole time. But of course they weren't, which is a nice ending to that story. And the civil war does not happen. But these are all the stories that we have about Reuven. It's all stories of desire for power, wanting it, but just can't do it. It's the tragedy of Reuven. Whatever it is about him, he just can't pull himself out. He just can't be that leader that he really wants to be, which is why we call him the should have been leader. He was the before. He should have been the leader, but he never really actually makes it. Who is what Reuven always wanted to be? That, of course, leads us right into Yosef. Yosef is everything Reuven wished he was, but I still call Yosef the second in command leader, and we'll see why. Yosef, when we start off hearing about Yosef and Bereishit, he is the chosen. He is the one, right? The Pesukim tell us, Eila Toldos, Yaakov. These are the generations of Yaakov. When you see the words Eila Toldos, you assume, most of the time, a list, right? So I would have assumed next, Reuven, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda. That's what I would have assumed, right? These are the generations of Yaakov. Let me hear about his children. Sometimes in Tanakh, when it says Eila Toldos, it lists only one child. And a lot of times that happens, or all the time that happens, I should say, is because we're picking the chosen child. The child that's going to lead us to the chosen person, right? We have that a few times. What do we have here? Eila told us Yaakov, Yosef. That's it, Yosef. He's the chosen one. And we go on to talk about Yosef, all about him, right? How he was 17 years old. He likes to either play or boss around the children of Bilhah and Zilpah. He tells his father, tattles on his brothers to his fathers. Yisrael, Gepazah Gimel, Yisrael, Ahavet Yosef, Mikol Banav. We are so clear here. This is not subtle love. This is real. Yaakov loves Yosef best. And everybody knows it. And it's very clear that he is the favorite, the Pesukim that I brought earlier, in Bereishis Islam and Gimel, I brought it here again. Who's in the back when we meet up with Esav? Who is the one that's most protected? That's Yosef, right? He is the favorite child, the seemingly chosen child of Yaakov. Now, it's not just Yaakov who feels this way about Yosef. It's actually Yosef who feels this way about Yosef. And we see that very clearly when he starts telling over his dreams. I am going to be the stalks of wheat, and you're all going to bow down to me, and I'm going to be the star, and everybody's going to bow down. Now, as we see in the future, he does get major leadership role, and that could be a very big form of nevuah. But one thing we have to say about Yosef, not too smart in thinking about consequences, meaning, if you're going to go to your brothers, your older brothers, and say, in the future, you are going to bow down to me. In the future, I'm going to be your leader. They're not going to like you. They are not, right? They are really not. And of course, bad things are going to happen because they outnumber you. They outpower you. I mean, you know, as we know, of course, is what happened. Yaakov, Yosef, I would say about him, you know, he does have a consequence problem, which we'll see throughout, which is he doesn't always think it through as much as he probably should have to what's going to happen in the future. But Yosef has a true desire for power. His father has put him in that position. He wants it. He wants to be the leader. He dreams of being the leader of his brothers. It's something that he truly wants. But of course, amongst his brothers, he is not the leader whatsoever, right? Yosef goes through ups and downs in his life. He's at an up when he's at a very young age in his father's house. He is on top of the world in his father's house. But then comes his big downer. One day he goes out to the field to check on his brothers. He takes off his coat, the ketonet pasim that his father gave him to symbolize this extreme love, and they throw him in a pit. Then they sell him as a slave. This is a major down in Yosef's life. But what's fascinating about Yosef is the leadership qualities, the charm that he has, takes him through, which is he gets sold to Potiphar. And the next thing we know, in Perek Lamed Tet, he is the most successful person in the house of Potiphar. And he goes from being this lowly, nothing servant to the head of Potiphar's entire house. So we see he has those successful qualities. He has the leadership qualities. He has the charm. Didn't work on his brothers, but seems to work on everybody else. He has the qualities to be a leader. Then, of course, he has a downtime in his life once again when the wife of Potiphar, who has a crush on him, makes up a nice lie about something he did to her. He goes back in jail, a downer time. But again, his qualities bring him back up. Even in jail, he's able to charm his way to be the head of a few of the jail cells and get some more privileges than everyone else. You know, brings him back up. He still has a down, as we gave here, where Saha Mashkin forgets about him. He has to stay in jail for a while. But then, of course, he has his big back up again when he gets brought out to Paro, interprets Paro's dreams, and becomes second in command. And that tells us a lot about Yosef. Again, his charm, his leadership qualities, in that what is he able to do when with Paro? He comes up with a plan of of saving food, which may not sound like the smartest plan in the world, but that he's able to execute it, right? Meaning he is able to collect the food for 7 years from all the people of Mitzrayim to save enough food to feed the entire world once the famine hits. I mean, that shows tremendous, tremendous leadership qualities that, of course, Yosef for sure has. So we have major leadership qualities. We do have a slight desire for power, but I think in some ways that helps him throughout all of his down periods, because if he didn't have a desire to be that, then he wouldn't, when he was sitting in jail, would have been like, life's over. You know, oh well, you know, what am I going to do? But Yosef was never like that. Yosef always says, I know there's something better for me. I'm going to get out. And from that personality, from that desire, grew a great thing, which was he was able to get himself out. But of course, sometimes desire for power can get us into trouble as well. On top of that, the third quality that we see in Yosef is that there is a weakness in Yosef. There are three times that Yosef, we have stories where he just breaks down and starts crying. The first time is when the brothers say, when they don't realize he understands their language, you know, really, this is all, these bad things are happening to us, and then this man, this weird guy, is accusing us of being spies and all that because of what we did to our brother Yosef. And he leaves the room, he just starts crying. The second time, when he sees Binyamin for the first time, leaves the room and just starts crying, can't handle it. And then, of course, the third time, when Yehuda stands up to him and says, you can't take Binyamin, and gives him the whole story, and Yosef is too weak to face Yehuda, just starts crying. So even though he has the leadership qualities, when he has to face Yehuda, when he has to face something, you know, emotionally difficult for him, Yosef does break down a bit. There is an emotional weakness going on with Yosef. And of course, the next story of Yosef, a very strange one, Perek Mem Zayin, which I didn't give you the whole Perek. I happen to have given a shir on this here in Midrash Yom Rishon a year ago, 2 years ago, I don't remember, about what is the point of this parak, right? In this parak, Yosef takes the entire riches of the entire Mitzrayim and basically takes it for power, right? He sells, first they have to give him all their money, then they give them all their animals, then they give them all their land. It's a very, very strange story. And there's lots of ways to understand the story. But just very simply, one could see it in one of two ways, which is Yosef gets a little bit overboard. Yosef says, wow, I really have an opportunity to just get and get and get and get. And he gets a little bit carried away. And the problem with that, of course, is you can understand why later on the Egyptians start to hate us, right? All of a sudden we go from Bereishit, where Yosef saves the day, and we have no problems between the Mitzrayim and the Jewish people. And then we have Shemot, they hate us, and they're enslaving us. When? What happened? Where did that come from? And it could be that there was a hatred. There was a hatred because they associated this horrible time where they lost everything to Yosef. Or it's possible that Yosef was really this puppet to Paro. If you look throughout, it keeps saying everything is the power. He's really second in command to Paro. As we see, he's always second in command to Potiphar, second in command to Paro. As we'll see throughout his life, he's always going to be second in leadership to Yehuda, right? He's always second in command, right? But in this situation, Paro wanted to get all this money, and he saw an opportunity of a scapegoat in Yosef, saying, wow, I can get Yosef to get all this money. The Egyptians will hate Yosef, they won't hate me, because he's going to get all the money for me. And then, of course, that ends up in a bad situation for the Jews. So either it was all Yosef's idea, and then again, that's an issue of not seeing the consequences of the future, not seeing that in the future the Egyptians are going to hate the Jews for what the actions of Yosef were. Or it's again showing us the second in commandness of Yosef, where no matter how hard he tries and no matter how much he wants that leadership position, he always remains in a number two position. What's interesting is Bereishit ends in a very weird way, which is you think the Sefer Bereishit, as we're going to read soon, ends about everybody, you know, everybody dies, right? We have the brachos about everybody. But really the focus of the very end of the Sefer is all about Yosef. Bereishit is a Sefer, really. The ending is about Yosef. Where I gave in the last few psukim of Bereishit Perek Nun, we hear about the death of Yosef twice. Vayishev Yosef in Mitzrayim, hu beit aviv, vayechi Yosef me'av eser shanim. He dies at the age of 110. We hear that again in Pasuk Havav, vayem Yosef ben me'av eser shanim, he's 110. And all we have at the very end is Yosef making people swear that he'll be taken out of Mitzrayim. And we don't hear anything about the death of anyone else. Meaning Yosef really is the focal point of the end of Sefer Bereishit. He's the chosen child in some ways of Yaakov, even though we'll see a twist on that in a little bit when we do Yehuda. He's the chosen child. He wants the power. He gets the power in Mitzrayim, second in command power, but he gets it. He has the qualities of power. He has good qualities of power, but he has some flaws. Number one, he likes power a little bit too much, maybe. He doesn't always see the consequences of all of his actions, and he has an emotional weakness. And this is what we are going to see in all of his descendants, which is Yosef dominates a lot of our leadership positions throughout Torah, 100% throughout Tanakh. We have many, many leaders from Yosef, which makes sense. He has the personality, he has the quality. A lot of times these leaders are going to be leaders that choose themselves, that want to be the leader and choose it for themselves, as opposed to that get chosen by God. Some of them are chosen by God as well. And we'll see a lot of these exact personalities, good leaders, but some emotional weaknesses and some not seeing the consequences, all coming out through their stories. The first person, well, before we get to the people, what we see is the first down of the Yosef, which is very interesting. He may dominate Bereishit, but he does not dominate Torah, which is, as soon as we get to Shemo, the next psukim, it tells us, you know, all the generations, these are names of everyone, it tells us about Yosef dying again, Vayemet Yosef v'chol echa v'chol ador ahu, and then it tells us that the Jewish people multiply, and then Vayaka melech chadash al Mitzrayim asher lo yadat Yosef. Then we have a new king of Mitzrayim that does not know Yosef, and then Yosef disappears from the text. I was reading Shemot Aleph. He disappears. We really go through all of Torah, and we have almost nobody from Yosef. We have almost nothing from Yosef. We have two small stories. The story of Benot Tzlafchad, who are from Menashe. They are the girls who came up into Moshe and said, we're not going to get Naphtali. We have no brothers. Our father deserved land. Give us a piece of land. To which Moshe then says, okay, no problem. And he, I mean, after discussing it with God and stuff, says, you can have a piece of land. We then have Menashe getting very upset and saying, how can you give Benot Tzlafchad a piece of land? What if they marry somebody from a different Shevet? Now our Shevet's going to lose land, which is a very Yosef thing, right? We don't want to lose land, we don't want to lose power, we don't want to lose anything. They get very upset. So Moshe solves their problem. But that's really it that we hear of Yosef in Torah. But then Yosef pops back up really strongly in the next few hundred years, which is Yehoshua comes from Ephraim, and majority of the Shoftim in the time period of Sefer Shoftim are from Yosef. Then we move on to Yehuda, which we'll get to in a little bit, of the kings. We have David and Shlomo. But then when the Melucha splits in the time of Rechavam with Yeravam, Yeravam being back from Yosef, and then of course the whole Malchus Yisrael versus Melech Ben David, Malchus Yisrael is being led by Yosef. So we have the ups and downs in history of Yosef, just as we did in Sefer Bereishit. So let's just run through some of them. Yehoshua, of course, begins us off as a very, very strong leader, but there are a great leader, which befits Yosef. But there are a few things that characterize him to make him sound very similar to a person that would be coming from Yosef. Number one, when we think of Yehoshua, we for sure think of him as a number two to Moshe. Now, he is a leader in his own right, but every time we think about him, and every time I think he thinks about himself, he sees himself as that second to Moshe. Meaning when we meet up with Yehoshua for the first time in Shemot Yitzayin in the war against Amalek, Moshe is the one on the mountain holding up his hands, Yehoshua's down in the battlefield fighting, right? He is kind of not partners with Moshe. He's listening to Moshe's command. He's the one beneath Moshe. Many times when we hear about him in the next two psukim I gave you here, he's called the Misharet Moshe. He's called the helper of Moshe. That's really who he is. And then, of course, when he gets chosen to be the leader, he gets the leadership with Moshe putting his hands on him, the Samachta Tzedek Alav, and his Ruach of Moshe gets put on Yehoshua. And then throughout Sefer Yehoshua, we hear stories that were like, oh, we heard that before. That's the exact same story we heard by Moshe. We have the splitting of the Yarden, just like we have the splitting of the Yom Suf. We have the same kind of Sne experience where he meets up with a Malach and he has to take off his shoes because the land he's standing on is holy. We have a lot of similar events that happen to Yehoshua, just like what happened to Moshe. And of course, almost everything that Yehoshua does was something that God commanded Moshe to do. And then Moshe, since he couldn't do it because he wasn't like God himself, commanded Yehoshua to do. Everything is a link back to Moshe. It's not that God commanded Yehoshua straight, and he talks to him in Sefer Yehoshua, but everything Yehoshua accomplishes was what God had originally told Moshe that Moshe was supposed to do, and now Yehoshua is the one playing it out. He's very much the second to Moshe, just like Yosef is always second to. On top of that, Yehoshua has a weakness emotionally as well, which we see very clearly. Number one, we know about Yehoshua. Yeah, he is one of the Meraglim, right? Yehoshua and Kalev are the two good Meraglim. And what's interesting is just for Yehoshua in Bamidbar Yegimel, Pasuk Tetzayin, Moshe goes and changes Yehoshua's name from Hoshea to Yehoshua. Of course, all the Mepharshim say, why? He needed extra strength, extra something to get him through. Kalev didn't need it, Yehoshua did, again showing a weakness in that Moshe was worried about him, was worried he wouldn't be able to make it through, needed a little extra help. And what's interesting is when the Meraglim story plays itself out and the Jewish people all start crying because the Meraglim say these bad things, Kalev steps up. Yehoshua does not. We don't hear a word coming from Yehoshua, was not strong enough to kind of break through and to help out at all. And on top of that, I think very powerful to show this little of weakness of Yehoshua is the next, I guess, number of sources I gave you here. Four times in Devarim, when Yehoshua is being spoken about or spoken to, Moshe says to him, Chazak v'amatz, Chazak, be strong. And then in Yoshua Perek Aleph, four times again, whether it's Moshe, whether it's Hashem, whether it's some of the tribes, they say to him, Chazak v'amatz, Chazak v'amatz. You don't say Chazak v'amatz to somebody who's strong, right? Someone who's strong doesn't need to hear it. Doesn't need to hear, you'll be okay. He knows he's going to be okay. Doesn't need to hear it. Who needs to hear? Over and over. Eight times. Chazak v'amatz, Chazak v'amatz. Someone who's worried. Now, we don't blame Yoshua for being worried. I mean, he's filling the shoes of Moshe. I cannot blame Yoshua at all. And he does an excellent job in his leadership. We look at him as one of our best leaders. But you can understand, he was worried. He was scared. He needed that Chazak v'amatz. Maybe one can claim about Yoshua. It's very unclear in the text if we do blame him or not. The consequence problem and not seeing the consequences of the future. But there are different psukim that discuss the problem of Sefer Shoftim, which is the fact that we don't kill out all of our enemies. And one might, as the pasuk somewhat blames Yehoshua a little bit in Shoftim Perek Bet, when it's talking about the fact that we're having troubles now in Sefer Shoftim because we didn't kill out all of our enemies, it says, Gam ani lo asif laharish ish mipneihem min hagayim asher azav Yehoshua vayamot. Who are the people giving you trouble? The people giving you trouble are the ones that were left over by Yehoshua before he died. So is it that we're saying Yehoshua didn't finish killing out all the people there and we blame him for it? Or is it just a fact saying, you know, by the time Yehoshua died, we still didn't kill out everyone else? Possibly, if it's true that Yehoshua maybe didn't as much as he could, and one could read that into the psukim, make sure that all the nations were kicked out of Eretz Yisrael before he died, one could see that as a problem of seeing the consequences of the future, because the future looked really bad. I mean, if you look at Sefer Shoftim, it's probably our lowest time of our history based on the fact that we don't kill out all of our enemies in the time of Sefer Yoshua. We don't kill out all those people, and therefore, of course, we go and we start serving their Avodah Zarah, and then God leaves us and we get into all sorts of trouble. Other times that we hear about Yosef in the Sefer Yehoshua, and not about Yehoshua himself, is the B'nai Yosef come complaining to Yehoshua. And it kind of reminds us of Menashe complaining to Moshe, right? As we said before, Menashe complains that B'nai Tzlafcha will marry other people and they'll lose land. B'nai Yosef comes to request of Yehoshua after he gives them their goral, you didn't give us enough land. We need more land. We need more. We need more. And Yehoshua says to them, go away. You know, basically, you got enough. Leave me alone. But that's a quality we see in Yosef. Always wanting more, always wanting more power, wanting more land, and we'll continue to see that as we keep going through their stories. Then we get to Sefer Shoftim, and Sefer Shoftim is full of Yosef, which is wonderful, because in the time of Shoftim, we don't have leaders, we need leadership, we need someone to step up. Yosef is always going to be the one to step up, because he wants it. He wants that leadership position. We need it. It's wonderful. We have a bunch of Shoftim that come from Yosef. We'll discuss some of them. We have, number one, we have Devorah, we have Gidon, we have Yiftach, we have Yair, we have a whole bunch. So Devorah is a very, very strong leader, a complicated leader, so we're going to maybe discuss her another time. Gidon, however, we see a lot of the signs of Yosef, where, first of all, when we start off with Gidon, Gidon is very unsure of himself. Kind of reminds us of Yehoshua a bit, and reminds us again of the weakness of Yosef, which is he's lacking that emunah, a little bit weak and getting emotionally, having some issues. Where we see that very clearly in Gidon is he's told to please go lead the Jewish people to battle, and he has to go destroy an idol first, and he can't do it. He is so scared, he can't do it. And God has to give him four signs, four! I mean, that's a lot of signs that he has to get from God in order to be able to go out there and fight this war. I mean, he is a bit scared, right? This is a Yosef more type quality. We wouldn't see this in a Yehuda person, but Yosef, he's very scared. What are his signs? Just to remind us, right? He first has to put some bread and meat and soup on a rock and a fire comes down and eats it up. Then he has to put some cotton on the ground and then the cotton is wet and the ground is dry when he wakes up in the morning. The next morning, right, the ground is wet and the cotton is dry, right? They flip it, right, because he's just too nervous. And then God says to him the night before battle, if you're still too nervous, go down and check out the enemy. He goes to check out the enemy, overhears that the enemy talking to themselves saying, one guy said, I had a weird dream. There was a bread rolled down the hill, knocked over a tent. The other guy says, oh, that's the Jewish people, the bread is going to come and knock at our army. Then Gidon finally says, okay, I will go. So we see, again, good leader Gidon. He for sure is able to conquer our enemy. He has an ingenious strategy of how he actually wins. But he does have this weakness, emotional weakness, where he just is too scared to go out to war, needs a lot of help in order to get there. Also, at the end of the Gidon story, we see a consequence problem, meaning once again, he doesn't see the results of something that he does. And there's two stories where we can see that. Number one, at the end, again, showing he's a good leader, the people ask ask him to be king. And a little uncharacteristic of a Yosef character, he says no. But after that, the rest of the Sefer Shoftim is all about leader after leader that just are terrible. And that we end the Sefer with, Ein Melech Bisrael, this is our problem. And maybe it's possible he should have said yes. And maybe it's possible that had he done that, we would have avoided a lot of the issues. But the second to last story, the last story now is the real one where we see problems, where Gidon at the very end takes some of the booty that they won in the war and he creates an ephod. He creates this nice symbolic piece where everyone's supposed to look at and remember the victory and of course serve God. And very soon, even during while he is alive, people start serving that as Avodah Zarah, and then afterwards they go back to full all of Avodah Zarah, and of course bad things start to happen to us as well. So he builds his own, the thing that then becomes the Avodah Zarah that we all serve, and of course creates very bad things for the Jewish people. That's Gidon, similar to a Yosef character. On top of that, during the time of Gidon, after the war is over, the Bnei Yosef come yelling at Gidon, why didn't you invite us to war? Now again, this reminds us again why we don't want to lose land. We don't, Menashe story, and again, the Yoshua story. We want more land. Why didn't you invite us to, in the conquering? We could have gotten more booty. What is your problem? And of course, he says to them, I called you to war. You just didn't come. Like, what is your problem? But it's always Yosef. I want more. I want to be more involved. I want. That's the Yosef quality that we see here as well. We then move on to the next Yosef character, which is, of course, Avimelech. Avimelech, I think, is all the bad that we could take of Yosef and stick it into one character, which is the extreme desire for power and corruption by power. This is a man who is of a different mother than the rest of his brothers. This is the son of Gidon, but from a different wife. Just like Yosef has a different mother than the rest of his brothers. And he hates his brothers, similar to a bad relationship Yosef has. But he does something that Yosef, thank God, does not do. He then goes and kills out 69 of his brothers, kills them, and declares himself as king of the Jewish people. He calls himself Avimelech, that is not his name, but if you look at the pasuk I gave you in Shoftim Chet, Vayesem et Shemo Avimelech, he makes his name Avimelech. He said, my father's king. As if he wasn't, but as if he was. So I deserve to be king. He appoints himself as king of the people of Shechem. And of course that does not end well, because anyone who doesn't like him, he goes and he kills until, thank God, finally a woman drops a stone on his head and wounds him, and then he dies. So we have the extreme corruption of power of the Yosef trait put into this one character of Avimelech. Yair HaGiladi, if you keep going, say for Shoftim, also a Yosef character. And the only thing we know about him, he's from Menashe, we know about him is that he has 30 sons who ride on 30 donkeys. That's in Shoftim Yud that I gave you here. A very weird description of somebody. We don't hear of a war he fights. We don't hear of anything. Oh, he has 30 sons on 30 donkeys. It sounds very much like a king, right? Kings would ride around and their princes on donkeys and showing off to everybody. It sounds very much like we have this rich guy who wants to be the leader in some way, and he treats his sons as if they're kings and acting out in a little bit of a haughty fashion. Again, this desire for power, we don't really hear very much good that Yair does, and it's very unclear to us who this Yair was as well. But then we get to Yiftach, our next Shofet. That is clearly a Yosef character, a Yosef story. It's very, very clear. Who is he? He is the son of a different wife, once again, sounding just like Yosef. He is rejected by his brothers, just like Yosef. The brothers hate him, throw him out of the house, just like Yosef got thrown in the pit by his own brothers and then sold. And then he has to wander in the desert, and he becomes the leader of the people, these lowly Anashim Reikim from the desert. Meaning he has a leadership quality. People like him, but he gets thrown out of his own house. So he leads the people that he comes across, just like Yosef, making it good in Egypt. And then one day, when the people are in major trouble, the people of Gilad, his own town, comes crying to him, please come back and lead us, we're in big trouble. Just like the brothers come crying, they don't know it's Yosef, but they come crying to Yosef to save them when they're in trouble in the time of the famine. It's the exact same story happening again. And we have Yiftach's reaction kind of like Yosef's. I'll lead you, I'll take care of you, I'll fix your problems, but you have to, Anochi Elechem Lerosh, I have to be your leader, right? I want to be your leader, I've always wanted to be your leader, you kicked me out, you treated me badly, I'll come back and help you, but I'm your leader, right? I want to assert my power over you. That's a Yiftach. That's the Yiftach story, and it's an exact Yosef story. Of course, the ending of Yiftach's story reminds us of Yosef in the consequence problem, where the very tragic ending of Yiftach is that he makes a swear, anything that comes out of my house when I come home from this war, I will sacrifice to God, and of course, out comes his daughter. It's a horrible, horrible, that was not thinking clearly when he made that swear, whether he kills his daughter or just sends her away, whichever way you want to learn that story, it's a tragic ending, and it's obviously not thinking through the consequences of your actions, of thinking about what you meant when you said that swear. And that is a Yosef characteristic. We then move on again with Yiftach. The people of Ephraim come yelling at Yiftach, why didn't you invite us to war? Again, Yiftach says to them, I did invite you to war, you didn't come. Again, this complaint that we have of Yosef over and over, you didn't involve me, you're taking away from me, it's a problem, over and over and over again. And this time it turns really bad, where Ephraim and Manasseh turn against each other and they have a civil war right there in the middle of Sefer Shoftim. And we see them butting heads. And what are they butting heads about? What is their problem? They're both saying, we want to lead, we want to be in charge, you didn't call us, we're insulted. Just because the leader is now from Manasseh, why didn't you call Ephraim? And if the leader's from Ephraim, why didn't you call Manasseh? They're butting heads. They both want that power, leading us up to a civil war, which is really quite sad. And you see it as Ephraim led in the time of Yoshua, and then Ephraim leads when it's Devorah, but then Manasseh kind of takes over in the Gidon, in the Ya'ir, in the Yiftach, and Ephraim getting mad because he's not being invited, and I'm in charge too. And they fight. And this is a Yosef thing, where they want that power, and they get upset when they don't get it. And we see the story over and over and over again, already in the time of Moshe, with the power, the wanting the land, Yoshua wanting more land, and now two times in Sefer Shoftim, fighting for not being involved in a battle that therefore ends up in a civil war, and it's really quite sad. Ending us off with two other characters, Micha, the crazy story at the end of Sefer Shoftim, of Pesel Micha, of this man who builds a Pesel, and then all the sides that this guy, who's a Yisrael, is really a Kohen, and then he meets a Levi and says, oh, yeah, the Levi, he could be a Kohen. It's a guy who really just wants people to come to him and serve in his house, and he can put some sort of authority over them, and therefore he decides to make this house of worship in a way that's completely and utterly ridiculous, which is, again, a characteristic of Yosef. And then, of course, we end with Yerubbaam and all of the kings that come from Yosef afterwards, where at the end of the day, Yosef takes back over. We have a downtime of Yosef, where when we have kings, we have David, we have Shlomo, great kings. But then, of course, Yosef comes back and takes over the Malucha and takes away 10 of the tribes, and Yosef is up back again. So we have this ups and downs of Yosef throughout history, just like Yosef's own life, which had a lot of ups and downs. A desire for power, taking power whenever they possibly can, and getting upset when they are not invited or when they lose from their power. We have emotional weakness that we see throughout, and we have a problem of consequences that they don't seem to see. But again, in general, Yosef is a tremendous leader that we have, normally always second to Potiphar, second to Paro, second to Moshe, and then of course, as we'll see, always second to Yehuda throughout our history. So let's move on to the real leader, Yehuda, which is as follows. When Yehuda is born, you'd say, why doesn't Yehuda have the same problem as Reuven? He's born to the same mother, the same terrible situation. But you see right away from the attitude, from when he's born, the situation's much better by the time he's born. How what's he named? He's not named, oh, my husband hates me. He's named Habam, Hapam Odet Hashem. This time I praise God. Meaning by the time she has her fourth child, which is Yehuda, things are better for her. Things are happier in the home. Yaakov is more with her. Maybe Yaakov loves her more. Yehuda does not grow up in that same horrible situation that Reuven did. And because of that, I think he is therefore able to be the shining star that Reuven was not able to be. We see very clearly that he is the chosen leader of his brothers. When he says, let's sell Yosef, the Pasuk tells us in Bereishis Lamed Zayin Pasuk Chaf Vav, Vayishmu Achav, they listen to Yehuda. And that throughout all the stories, we'll see Yehuda really leads the brothers in every single way. We have a strange story that kind of interrupts in the middle of this, which is Yehuda leaves his brother, and we have the whole Yehuda and Tamar incident. But it's very revealing to us about the Yehuda character, which is okay. He had a little bit of a down in his life. He has a flaw, as we'll see throughout history of women. Every single sketchy woman story that we ever have in the entire text of Tanakh is always a Yehuda character, right? So here he sleeps with a prostitute who's really his daughter-in-law. It's a little bit of a funny situation. But we see from here the flaw of Yehuda, which is always going to be women. We're going to have that flaw with David, with Shlomo, with a whole lot of people. It's always going to be a Yehuda problem. But we also see he has an ability to admit to his mistake. He says, Sakami Meni at the end, he admits that he slept with her and that Tamar really is righteous in what she did, and that's also going to be a Yehuda character, which is he may mess up, but he will always fess up to what he does and therefore fix whatever problems that he has, and that makes him a very good leader. Of course, what we see his leadership role is when it comes to him facing off with Yosef, even before he knows that it is Yosef. But the big story of when he has to bring Binyamin down to Mitzrayim, number one, he is the one who's able to convince his father to let him take down Binyamin. He doesn't just go to his father once, he goes back again. That's a leadership quality, to know, I'm not going to give up just because you say no to me. I'm going to come back again, and I'm going to fight harder. That's a leader. And he comes back to Yaakov again and says, I need to take Binyamin down, until Yaakov, of course, gives in. And then when things get rough and Yosef says, I'm keeping Binyamin because he stole my goblet, Yehuda faces this king who has a ton of power, could kill him in a second, faces him with this long speech. I mean, it's really a weird speech. I mean, in some ways you could read the speech to be like, it's not my fault. It's your fault, Yosef. I mean, doesn't say Yosef, doesn't know it's him. You're the one who told us to bring him down. You're the one who asked us all these weird questions. It's not our fault, it's your fault. Let us take Binyamin home. And of course, who wins in the conflict of Yehuda versus Yosef? Yehuda every time. And what happens to Yosef? He starts crying, breaks down, and of course gives in. I need Yosef. And that, of course, ends our story. Yehuda is the one who is the leader, has the clear leadership qualities, and even Yaakov sees it by the end, because who does he send first to go down to Mitzrayim to set up Goshen and to make sure everything was okay? He didn't leave it up to Yosef. He sends down Yehuda. And at the very end, I think the most ironic twist of the end of Sefer Bereishit is when he's giving out the bracha, and he gives a special bracha to Ephraim and Menashe. You'd think everything's going to Yosef, right? The brothers are going to get, you know, the secondary prize at the end, and everything's going to Yosef. And then when he gives Yehuda the bracha, and he says to him, you get the malucha, oh my gosh, it blows your mind. Really? Really? After all that, you favored Yosef, you thought he was the best, and now you're giving it to Yehuda. Yaakov realized the leadership quality, the ideal leader, is not a Yosef, it's a Yehuda. And that's why throughout our history, all ideal leaders and our strong leaders all come from Yehuda. They also come from Levi, but Levi we don't even have time to start with, because that would really take us way past our time. But all of our strong leaders, besides for our Levi characters, are always going to come from Yehuda. We have Kalev ben Yefuna, which is that second spy that we spoke about, the one who is able to stand up to the Jewish people. And the Pasuk tells us in Bamidbar Yud-Gimel, Vayahas Kalev Ata'am, he is able to quiet them, and he is able to say, wait a second. Of course, they don't listen to him, but at least he has that ability to stand up there and quiet them for a moment. And of course, we know about Kalev as well. He's in charge of the Yehuda army in the time of Sefer Yoshua and time of Shoftim, and they kill out every enemy that they have. Kalev is the one who's in charge, and he is able to defeat every single enemy except for one in one valley somewhere, where all the rest of the tribes are not able to in Sefer Shoftim. Second character we have is the character of Hor. Hor is one of those people that is set in charge when Moshe goes up on Har Sinai with Yoshua, and he says, Aaron and Hor are in charge. And then Hor disappears from the text. And we have the famous medrash quoted by Rashi, what happened to Hor? Hor is dead. Why is he dead? Because when the people came to Aaron and Hor, first they went to Hor, and they said, we want to build an Egel. Hor said, absolutely not. And they said, but we want to. And he said, no. And they killed him because he was that strong. He's a Yehuda character. I absolutely will not give in. Aaron was a little more sympathetic. Hor would not give in, and for that he got killed. Bezalel, our next one, he is the one who builds our Mishkan, and the adjective that was given to him about how smart he was and how wise he was in the text is unbelievable, and he's the one, of course, chosen to build the Mishkan. Nachshon ben Aminadav, and all, he is the head of the Degel of Yehuda in the Midbar, and of course, the famous thing we know about him from the Gemara in Sota is he's the one that kafats Nachshon ben Aminadav v'yirad l'am tchila, when they are in front of the Yamsuf and the Mitzrim are behind them and they don't know where to go. Nachshon's the one who jumps in. A Yehuda character without fear, fearless characters, that's Yehuda, jumps right into the water. Achan takes us off our path of good Yehuda characters to not so good ones, but Achan is the one that in the time of Sefer Yoshua, they're told do not take any of the booty that is left over from the war of Jericho, and Achan goes and takes it, and for that he gets stoned to death, but at least before he gets stoned to death, he admits his mistake, which again is a characteristic of a Yehuda. Otniel ben Kenaz, who in the time of Yehoshua, fights this war. It's an actually incredible war, because it's a war that even Kalev doesn't want to fight. Kalev says, anybody who wants to fight this war in this place, Kiryat Sefer, that has no water and nobody wants to live there, I'll give you my daughter. I mean, Kalev didn't want to do it, so he offered off his daughter to anybody who would possibly want to do it. Right? We only have another case of that, where Shaul offers his daughter for killing Goliath, right? Nobody wants to kill Goliath. He's a giant. You're scared of that. This is a parallel case, right? And what does Othniel do? Goes, fights, no problem. And of course, he's our first Shofet as well, standing up to our enemy. We have no details of this battle because he just goes and fights them without any fear. He didn't need signs. He didn't need anything. He goes and he fights. And in general, say for Shoftim, when we ask numerous times who is going to lead us, who is going to lead us, God answers, Yehuda Ya'aleh. Yehuda is going to lead. I'll skip the Pilegesh. We don't have time. Boaz as well, the story of Megillas Rus, all Yehuda characters. Boaz is very much like Yehuda, very parallel. Yehuda who forgets his Yibum Chiyuv, I guess. Yehuda is supposed to marry off his next son, to Tamar and never does. And we have Boaz, who is supposed to, or we think is supposed to, marry Ruth and has a Yibam responsibility. Both get reminded of their responsibility by a very provocative woman in a very provocative way. And then, of course, they admit to being wrong at the end. Naomi as well from Yehuda, very similar to Yehuda, where both of them go off the path, have a husband and two children that die on them because of something that went wrong. And then, of course, both Naomi comes back, and Yehuda also comes back to join up with the Jewish people at the end. David and Shlomo, I don't even have to say, are strongest leaders. Both of them, of course, have women problems. David sleeps with a married woman. Shlomo has too many wives, causing problems. But at the end of the day, they are probably our strongest leaders. So we see from here is the strength of Yehuda, starting us off in Bereishit, where he is our strongest leader. He is the leader that is probably the ideal in a lot of ways, because he's the one with the characteristics to be that strong leader, and he is our leader throughout all of history, but he's not the one that steps up for that, meaning he waits until the position comes to him. Yosef is the one that kind of steps up when there is a position of leadership available. I see that we don't have time, sadly, to do Binyamin and Dan, who are also fascinating, but I'll end with Shimon. Shimon, what's very fascinating is, I call him the no-person leadership, because there is absolutely nobody that comes from Shimon at the very end. And the reason why, if you look through his stories, we have one real story of Shimon, which is, well, before we get to that one story, we have when he is born, his mother calls him Shimon, Ki Snua Anochi, obviously a very bad situation still going on, because I am hated, that is what his name is about. And we know, of course, the famous story of Shimon and Levi going, and they kill out Shechem, when Shechem goes and takes their sister Dinah and rapes her, and then Shimon and Levi have this crazy idea. They all get a bris milah. On the third day, we go and we wipe out the whole town. Yaakov is not very happy with this idea, screams at them, and that's the end. At the very end, of course, Yaakov yells at them in his bracha and says, what you did was horrible, and does not bless either Shimon or Levi. And also what we see, the other story of Shimon, is that when Yosef is deciding which one person should I put in jail, who do I hate the most that I want to leave him in jail, he, of course, picks Shimon. So Shimon was the big ringleader of the brothers, and possibly, you know, not in a very good way. What's very interesting, if you look throughout history of Shimon, Shimon is completely missing. The only person we have from Shimon in all of Tanakh is Zimri, who of course fits the Shimon role. He is the one that in front of everybody has a relationship with a Midian woman in the horrible story of Baal Peor, you know, making this big, I don't know what to call it, I mean, this horrible rebellion in front of all the Jewish people. Everybody sitting there watching him do this horrible act. And of course, Pinchas comes and stabs them both in the stomach and kills them both with a sword. But what's interesting, and why I wanted to do Shimon at the very end, is what's fascinating is that since the action of killing out Shechem was done by both Shimon and Levi, you know, you'd think that just like Shimon has this terrible future where there's no leaders that come from him and nothing that comes from him, basically, except for a bad person, Levi should have the exact same result. But we don't. Levi has the opposite. Levi has Moshe, Levi has Aaron, Levi has Korach. Okay, there are some bad people in Levi, too, that come aboard. But we have our best leaders, really, from Levi. Shmuel from Levi. Eli is also from Levi. And, of course, we have this last pasuk I gave you on the Sorshi in Devarim, where at the end of the day, Levi are our teachers. They are the person that if we ever have a problem, ever anything, we are supposed to go to the Kohen, we are supposed to go to the Levi. And anyone who doesn't listen to something that the Levi says to do, I mean, gets majorly punished. The Levi is really probably next to Yehuda or even above Yehuda in status. And what's fascinating, I think, is that we're reaching the time of Rosh Hashanah. It's something just to think about, which is sometimes you may have the characteristic to do something, or you may even have the you know, be similar to Shimon in that way. Levi and Shimon seem to have been the two troubled people. But somehow in their history, when it played out, Levi was able to pull himself out of that rut, and Levi was able to kind of make himself into who he did, which was probably one of our best tribes, or if not the best tribe, and the one that's supposed to be our teachers forever in history. I think that really shows you the power of tshuva in some sense, where Levi was able to kind of, you know, pull himself out and to have a totally different result, a totally different history than that of Shimon throughout Tanakh. I think I'm over my time, sadly. But what I was trying to prove from here, and if you go through the sources, maybe you can come up with the picture of Binyamin and Dan as well, the rest else the Shvatim I can't do because they don't have any stories, so there's really nothing to talk about. But what we see is that if you take the Tanakh as a whole, and you start from the beginning, and you kind of figure out the character, and you figure out what it means, and then you take it and you apply it to the rest, you see that the themes are endless, and you see that really it's one huge picture. It's not really a parsha at a time, which is somehow how we learn it. It's one huge picture that if we apply it, you know, we really see a beautiful huge picture at the end. Thank you very much.